Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and a warm welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Carmen.
And I'm Hendrik. Today, we're tackling a topic that everyone thinks they already know.
Exactly. We're talking about the Vikings. But not about what you're probably expecting. No horned helmets, no bloodthirsty barbarians who were only out for plunder.
Both of which are myths, by the way. The horned helmets for sure, but also this image of a purely warrior caste.
And that stereotype is so persistent. When you say Vikings today, people immediately think of, what's it called again? Vikings, the TV series. Or all those Hollywood films where there's nothing but fighting. It's become so ingrained in people's minds.
The crazy thing is, the Viking Age, roughly from the late 8th to the early 11th century, was so much more than that. We're talking about a highly complex society here.
And the vast majority of it consisted of farmers. Most of the Scandinavian population worked fields, raised livestock, lived completely ordinary
farming lives, basically. The so-called Vikings, the ones who actually went on raids, were a small minority. We don't have exact figures, but it was probably only a few percent. Mostly young men seeking fame and fortune, or organized bands from the upper class.
Just a few percent. That puts things into perspective, doesn't it? The rest were farmers, craftsmen, merchants, smiths, shipbuilders.
Society was divided into three tiers. Jarls, the nobility, Karls, the free farmers and craftsmen, and then the thralls, meaning slaves. And this structure was quite decentralized, especially in Norway. Around 800, there were probably 20 to 30 larger chieftain domains.
And these chieftains had their own following?
The so-called hirth, yes. Professional warriors who served the chieftain. But these were small core units, not mass armies. Young farmers' sons sometimes joined to gain glory and loot, but only temporarily.
That also explains why the image has changed so much over time. This society wasn't static.
The raids, which began in 793 with the attack on
Lindisfarne.
Exactly. They became increasingly difficult over time. European towns defended themselves better. The risk increased. The returns decreased. And that's when something fascinating happened.
They became traders.
Not overnight, of course, but the transformation was enormous. The Vikings suddenly used the same skills, navigation, shipbuilding, knowledge of the routes, for trade instead of raids. They built a network that stretched from Scandinavia to Byzantium and the Arab Caliphate.
And that's what we want to talk about today. How feared raiders gave rise to a veritable trading empire. What goods they traded, which routes they used, which towns they founded.
The Vikings established trading centers that became some of the most important hubs of their time. Birka in Sweden, Hedebø here in Schleswig-Holstein, these were international crossroads.
And the reach of these trade routes is truly impressive. From Greenland and Newfoundland in the west to Baghdad in the east. Arab sources from as early as the 9th century report Scandinavian traders, the so-called Varangians, right there. We'll take a closer look at all of this.
So, ready for a journey through the Vikings' trading network?
Absolutely. Let's get started.
So, Lindisfarne, 793, the raid on the monastery. That's often cited as the starting point of the Viking Age. But that's a bit too simplistic.
Because there had already been contact before that?
Among other things, Lindisfarne was more the moment when Christian chroniclers started paying attention. A monastery on a holy island attacked by heathens from the north, that sent shockwaves through all of Europe. But such raids didn't happen in a vacuum.
The Scandinavians had long established trading relationships. They knew the coastlines, knew where there was something worth taking. And monasteries were particularly attractive targets. Rich, unarmed, often isolated.
Golden chalices, reliquary shrines, gemstones in book covers, plus provisions, livestock. And the monks themselves had no military protection. From a raider's perspective, perfect loot with minimal risk.
What I find interesting, the Vikings didn't all come from the same region. Norwegians, Danes, Swedes, they had quite different, how should I put it, directions of expansion?
Geography had a strong influence on that. The Norwegians headed more westward, Scotland, Ireland, Iceland, later Greenland. They were often looking for land to settle because resources were scarce back home. The Danes, on the other hand, focused on Western Europe, England, France, the North Sea coast. Those were primarily...
So mainly raids.
And later conquests. The Dane law in England, for example. The Swedes, or Varangians as they were called in the east, travelled down the river routes, the Volga, the Dnieper, toward Byzantium and into the Caliphate.
And the Swedes were more focused on trade from the start. Birka was a Swedish centre, after all. The Varangians founded trading posts, helped build cities like Novgorod and Kiev.
So they had different strategies early on. But they all had one thing in common. The ships.
The longships.
They were truly revolutionary. Fast, manoeuvrable, seaworthy, and able to navigate rivers.
And all with a draft of often less than a meter.
Sometimes even less. Just imagine a ship 20, 25 meters long that could be crewed by 30 to 60 men, yet set so shallow in the water that it could sail up rivers.
That was the decisive tactical advantage. European towns expected attacks from the coast, but suddenly these ships appeared deep inland.
The clinker-built construction, overlapping planks joined with rivets, made them light and flexible. They could handle waves on the open sea, but also glide through shallow waters. Under sail, they averaged around 8 knots. Modern replicas, like the Sea Stallion, have even achieved 17 knots with a strong tailwind. That was faster than anything else on the water at the time. By the way, if details like these fascinate you, feel free to leave a like and subscribe to the channel. It helps us produce more episodes like this.
And then there's another aspect that we can't ignore. The plunder didn't just consist of gold and silver.
The slave trade. The Vikings took captives during their raids. People they then sold at the markets. Thralls, as they were called in Norse society, were an economic foundation.
Dublin was one of the Vikings' largest slave trading centers. From there, people were sold to Scandinavia, but also further into the Islamic world. We have to look at this soberly. The slave trade was an integral part of their economy, as dark as that may be.
The Vikings didn't apply the moral categories we know today. Slaves were trade goods, like furs or amber. And especially the eastern routes of the Varangians, via Novgorod and Kiev to Constantinople, relied heavily on this trade.
It shows how complex this society was. Warriors, traders, settlers, and also slave traders. All at the same time, depending on the region and opportunity.
And the ships were the tool that made all of this possible. Without this technology, neither the raids nor the trade routes would have been conceivable.
The fascinating point is this. This transformation from raider to trader didn't happen overnight. It was a process that spanned generations, and it had very pragmatic reasons.
The Europeans learned their lesson. In the 9th and 10th centuries, Coastal towns became better fortified. Monasteries sometimes got their own watchtowers. Kings assembled naval forces. The risk for attackers increased dramatically.
And at the same time, the Vikings realized trade is often more profitable. A successful raid brings a one-time haul, with losses, wounded, the risk of death. But an established trade route, that brings profit year after year.
It was a sober cost-benefit calculation. If you need 3 raids to get the same amount of silver that you can earn through 1 summer of trading, then you recalculate.
What fascinates me, the Vikings weren't ideologues. They didn't say, we're warriors now, or we're traders now. They did whatever worked.
And often it was the same man who did both. A raid to Ireland in spring, perhaps, trade in Hedeby in summer, back at sea in autumn. This strict separation between trader and warrior
barely existed.
Exactly. The sword at the belt was both weapon and status symbol of a successful businessman. The line was fluid.
And the trade goods were surprisingly diverse. Raw materials and animal products came from the north. Furs from bears, wolves, foxes. These were coveted throughout Europe. Plus, walrus ivory from the North Atlantic, which was as precious as... No, wait. First there was amber, of course. Then furs, then ivory. The amber from the Baltic Sea was legendary.
The Vikings had virtually a monopoly on certain Arctic products. Walrus ivory, for example, that came to Europe almost exclusively through them. Plus honey, wax, wool, dried fish, everything the North produced in abundance.
And what they got in return?
Was the opposite. Luxury.
Silk from Byzantium and the Islamic world, some of it originally from Central or East Asia, came to the North via middlemen. Spices. Pepper was incredibly valuable. Wine from Southern Europe. Glass beads, ceramics, finely crafted jewelry.
The archaeological finds in Birka and Hedeby demonstrate this impressively. Silk fragments were found there, Arab silver coins, these dirhams, by the thousands. This wasn't an occasional trading relationship, this was a systematic network.
And one aspect runs through both phases, the trade in people. The Vikings never stopped trading slaves. Only at some point they stopped going on raids themselves and instead bought captives from others and resold them.
The river routes to Byzantium and the Caliphate, alongside furs, it was primarily slaves being transported there. The Arab traveller Ibn Fadlan described this in the 10th century. Viking traders on the Volga, hawking people like cattle.
And this trade in people was also what connected both worlds. For the Vikings, it wasn't a moral question, but a line of business that linked the raids with the emerging trade.
What makes a transformation so remarkable? The Vikings kept their core competencies: navigation, shipbuilding, knowledge of the routes, and applied them to a new purpose. That's essentially economic adaptability at the highest level.
They pivoted their business model without abandoning the infrastructure. Ship technology remained the foundation. The routes stayed the same. Only the contents of the cargo changed, from plunder to trade goods.
And these trading centers they built, Birka, Hedeby, they were the foundation of the new economic model. Everything came together there. When we talk about the trade routes now, we first need to understand what distances the Vikings covered. It's... how should I put this? It's roughly like someone traveling from Norway to Baghdad today. Only without GPS, without maps, without a compass.
And without the certainty that anyone would even be waiting at the other end.
Let's look at the western route first. Scandinavia, Shetland Islands, Orkney Islands, Faroe Islands, Iceland, Greenland, and finally North America. That's a distance of over 5,000 kilometers. And the Vikings managed that in the 9th and 10th centuries.
In ships that were revolutionary, yes, but were mainly open boats. No fixed cabins. Weather protection came from tarps and tents on board. On the North Atlantic, in storms and among icebergs.
Iceland was permanently settled around 870. Greenland followed around 985 under Eric the Red. And Leif Erikson reached Vinland, meaning Newfoundland, around the year 1000. The archaeological site of Lons-o-Meadow proves this beyond doubt.
But how did they even navigate? Without a compass? Without modern aids?
That's actually fascinating. The Vikings used a combination of methods. Coastlines were important. They often sailed from landmark to landmark. At night, they oriented themselves by the North Star and other constellations. They also observed the behavior of seabirds. Birds flying out to sea indicate land nearby.
And then there's the theory about the sunstone. These translucent calcite crystals that could allegedly indicate the sun's position even under cloudy skies, through the double refraction of light.
Physicists have tested this in simulations, with astonishing results. An accuracy rate of over 90% on the Norway-Greenland route if you correct your position every 3 hours. However, it's not archaeologically proven. We don't have a sunstone from a Viking ship.
But it's mentioned in the sagas. The Rauðulfsþáttr describes how King Olaf used a solstaten during a snowstorm to find the sun.
That's true. And it would explain how they survived the critical lags across the North Atlantic, where fog and clouds could obscure the sun for weeks.
But the western route was only one half. The eastern route was at least as impressive, just completely different.
The Swedish Vikings, the Varangians, used the great river systems of Eastern Europe. Across the Baltic Sea to Novgorod, then down the Volkhov River, across Lake Ladoga, and then either down the Volga toward the Caspian Sea, meaning the Arab Caliphate, or down the Dnieper to the Black Sea and to
Constantinople, of course.
Miklagard, as the Vikings called it. The Great City. And this route even had an official name. The route from the Varangians to the Greeks. It was an established trade route.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And the Vikings didn't just trade there. Some stayed and became the bodyguard of the Byzantine emperor, the famous Varangian Guard.
In 988, Grand Prince Vladimir of Kiev sent 6,000 Vikings to Constantinople to support Emperor Basil II in a succession dispute. And they then stayed as a permanent elite unit. Known for their absolute loyalty, precisely because they were foreigners without local entanglements.
Harald Hardrada was one of them, wasn't he?
The later Norwegian king, yes. He served in the Varangian Guard in the 1030s, rose to commander, fought in Sicily and Bulgaria, and returned with enough wealth to finance a crown. These career paths, from Scandinavian farmer's son to elite warrior in Byzantium, they really existed.
And along these routes, settlements emerged that became real cities. Novgorod, Kiev. They were co-founded, or at least heavily influenced by Varangians. These weren't temporary camps. This was
permanent infrastructure. And when you look at the
reach, from Newfoundland in the west to Constantinople and the Caspian Sea in the east. Arab sources from the 9th century even mention Vikings in Baghdad, possibly even at the Persian Gulf. That's thousands of kilometers, in an era when most people never left their village.
The Vikings used similar ship technology, but different types. Longships for raids, broader knarrs for trade. The basic technique remained the same. Only the ship type was adapted to the purpose.
And these routes weren't one-way streets. Goods flowed in both directions. Furs and amber heading south, silk and silver heading north. Arab coins, dirhams, were found in Scandinavia by the thousands. That shows how intensive this exchange was.
A genuine network that connected three continents, and at its center, the Vikings' trading hubs.
Birka og Hedeby. These were the two most important nodes of this entire network, and each had its own distinct function.
Birka was located on the small island of Björkö in Lake Mälaren, in the heart of Sweden. Founded in the 8th century, it quickly became one of the most significant trading centers of the north. The location was cleverly chosen. Lake Mälaren was still an inlet of the Baltic Sea back then, so there was direct access to the sea, but protected from storms and hostile fleets.
At its peak, perhaps 700 to 1,000 people lived there. That doesn't sound like much today, but for that era, it was a real town, with craftsmen, merchants, warehouses, docking facilities.
And the archaeological finds there are impressive. Silk fragments, mostly Byzantine or Central Asian. Glass beads from the Near East. Silver jewelry from...
from the Arab world.
The dirhams, yes. Arab silver coins by the hundreds. That shows Birka wasn't just a regional market, it was an international trading hub. Goods from three continents came together here.
They traded local products like furs, fox, beaver, marten, plus honey and wax, both high-value export goods. Amber from the Baltic coast, and, well, then there were the slaves, who counted as trade goods.
Birka declined in the late 10th century. The reasons aren't entirely clear. Perhaps shifting trade routes, perhaps raids, perhaps the slow retreat of sea levels that made the harbor less accessible. What remains are the graves. Over 3,000 have been found.
And Hedeby? That was located quite differently.
Hedeby, or Heiterbu, as it's called in German, was situated on the Schlei, this long inlet of the Baltic Sea near Schleswig. And strategically, that was worth its weight in gold. From there, a short overland route led to the North Sea. That means traders could avoid the dangerous circumnavigation of Jutland.
That saved weeks of travel time. And the goods were simply transported overland?
Via a short portage route between the Schlei and the Treene. About 15 kilometers of land transport, then you could set sail again on the other side. That made Hedeby the perfect link between the North and Baltic Seas.
The town itself was...
heavily fortified even, with a massive semicircular rampart, 9 to 11 meters high, and with the Danewerke at its back. This wasn't an open settlement, this was a protected trading town.
And goods weren't just traded there, they were also produced. Archaeologists have found workshops for metalworking, glass bead production, textile manufacturing. This was a genuine craft center.
What makes Hedeby so special? It was a cultural melting pot. The chronicler Adam of Bremen reports in the 11th century that Christians lived alongside pagans there. Frisians, Saxons, Slavs, Scandinavians, all trading with each other.
In the graves, you can see this diversity again. Frankish swords, Slavic ceramics, Arab coins, Byzantine jewelry. The entire known world met here in trade.
Hedebu was finally destroyed in 1066 by Slavic forces. But the site wasn't forgotten.
And today you can visit all of this. The Viking Museum Heiterbu is one of the most important archaeological museums in Germany, with reconstructed houses, longships, original artifacts. Since 2018, the Danevirke Hedebu complex has even been a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Anyone interested in the Viking Age should really go there. It's history you can
touch.
And just a good hour from Wacken, practically around the corner for us.
These trading centers were the foundation of the entire system. Without Birka, without Hedebu, the network would never have worked. All the threads came together here.
When we look back at everything we've discussed, from Lindisfarne to Constantinople, from the longship workshops to the markets of Hedebu, a picture emerges that's so different from the cliché.
The Vikings were destroyers, yes. But they were also bridge builders. And that's perhaps the most astonishing thing about this story.
They connected regions that had barely had contact before. Arab silver coins in Scandinavian graves. Byzantine silk in Swedish settlements. In Iceland, they encountered Irish hermits, the Papa, who fled before them, as the Landnámabók reports. This was cultural exchange on a level that hadn't existed before in this form.
And this exchange left traces that extended far beyond the Viking Age. Dublin, for example, that was originally a Viking trading post, founded in 841 as a fortified settlement on the Liffey, today a city of millions.
York in England, the old Jorvik, was one of the most important Viking strongholds in Britain. The settlement structures, the streets, partly on Viking-era foundations. And in the east, Novgorod and Kiev, both shaped by Varangians. Kiev even became the capital of an entire realm, the Kievan Rus.
So they didn't just transport goods. They founded cities, established trade structures, opened up routes that were used for centuries.
The legacy is, how should I put it?
It's both economic and cultural.
Both, exactly. The trading practices developed in Birka and Hedebu, standardized weights, silver as currency, international trade relations, they shaped North and Baltic Sea trade for the long term. The Hanseatic League emerged centuries later on an entirely different basis, as an alliance of cities and merchants, not royally controlled like Hedebu, but used the same tried and tested routes.
And what personally fascinates me, this adaptability. The Vikings didn't cling to one model. When raids became riskier, they pivoted. They used their core competencies, navigation, shipbuilding, knowledge of the routes, for a new purpose.
That's perhaps the most important lesson from this story. Flexibility. Pragmatism. The ability to recognize opportunities and adapt without giving up your own strengths.
And in doing so, they blended cultures instead of merely
destroying them.
Exactly. In Hedebu, Christians lived alongside pagans. In the Varangian Guard, Scandinavians fought for Byzantine emperors. In Dublin, Irish and Norse traditions merged. It wasn't a one-way street.
The Viking Age was an era of transition. From raiding to trading, from isolation to interconnection, from local communities to international networks. The Vikings stood at the beginning of a development that fundamentally changed Europe.
And much of this we can still see today. At the Viking Museum Heiterbu, in the graves of Birka, in the city centres of Dublin and York. History hasn't vanished. It's waiting to be discovered.
And with that, we've come to the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening.
If you're interested in the Viking Age, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. There you'll find not only authentic gear, but also the blog, with many more articles on topics like this. History you can touch and read about.
And if you have questions or topic suggestions, send them our way. We love getting feedback.
Until the next episode.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.